door, arranged in descending size. The sofa in the living room was deep, with enough cushions to get lost in.
I like your place, he said.
Oh, that's right, you haven't seen it yet. We're still getting the hang of all the little quirks and house sounds, but the kids love having a little extra space. Speaking of, Billy, Flo, come give your favorite uncle a hug.
Claire's twins were at the dining room table, sitting across from each other over a vast, complicated jigsaw puzzle. It was a world map, but so far they were only halfway through Russia. In unison, they left the table to hug Stan. Billy and Flo were six, and both had unruly mops of dark hair. The main difference between them, aside from their gender, were the eyes. Billy's were small, narrow, and oddly calculating. Flo's were wide, wild, and joyful.
Hi, kids, he said.
Hi, Uncle Stan, they chanted.
Wow, you guys have grown, Stan told them. You were both in diapers the last time I saw you.
He gave the bottle of wine he'd brought to Claire.
You want a glass, or are you going to make me drink alone?
I'd love one, he said.
She ducked away to the kitchen, leaving Stan alone with the twins.
Now, remind me which one is which, he teased.
We look totally different, Billy said.
Ah, you must be Flo, Stan told him.
I'm Flo, Flo cried, giggling.
Nah, you're the other one, Stan said, and ruffled her bushy hair.
Uncle Stan, should we get a kitten? Flo asked.
Well, that depends. What does your mother think?
Their mother thinks their father is allergic,
Claire said, returning from the kitchen with two full glasses of wine.
Dad can sleep outside, Flo said.
She laughed and turned immediately to her brother.
Did you hear what I said? Mom said Dad's allergic to cats, and I said Dad can sleep outside. I'm sitting right here, Billy said.
He smirked, shook his head, and then returned to the puzzle. The novelty of Stan had already worn off. As Claire handed him the glass, she said,
Gosh, Stan, what happened to your hands?
He turned over his palms, still red and raw from the sledgehammer.
Oh, nothing.
It doesn't look like nothing.
I've been doing some work on the house.
You're leaving here with a pair of Max's work gloves. He has about a dozen pairs. He won't miss one.
She sipped her wine.
Come with me. I want to show you something. Bring your wine.
She flicked on the exterior light, then opened the sliding glass door and stepped outside. Stan followed her out onto the large entertainment deck that smelled like fresh wood stain. Full dark was creeping up on Milden, but the moon hung full and fat above them. Beyond the deck was a decent-sized yard. Fresh-cut grass, jumbo trampoline, blue plastic sandpit peppered with toys and—
Wait, Stan said. Is that—
Their tree, she said. I had it transplanted from the old place. It cost a fortune to move, and Max begged me to leave it behind, but as soon as it touched this soil, it started to thrive, as if it knew it was home.
A dogwood tree stood wide and tall against the back fence. The moonlight made its limbs look white and stark. Claire had planted it as a remembrance tree on the one-year anniversary of Lucy's death. It had been a tiny sapling then. Now it was tall and strong. Looking at the dogwood filled Stan with a heavy sadness. Its height marked the passage of time. While the tree grew, what had he been doing? Treading water, he thought. While the dogwood had been growing, Stan had existed like a worm crossing a never-ending concrete sidewalk on a sweltering August day. The worm edged forward inch by inch, without reason or purpose.
Do you ever think about the night she died?
He asked. He glanced over his shoulder to make sure Max wasn't in earshot. Stan doubted this conversation would count as keeping it light.
Sometimes, she said, I think of how different things might have been if she'd just called me. Things were so dark back then, for all of us, but I feel like I could have changed her mind, if only she'd given me the chance.
It wasn't your fault,
Stan said.
It wasn't yours either, Stan.
She took his arm in hers. They looked out over the neighborhood. Lights were blinking on in houses all across Milden.
Were you both at home when it happened?
Stan asked. When what happened?
The night Joanne died. Were you both home? You and Max, I mean.
She furrowed her brow, but before she could answer, a voice behind them said,
Smells like dinner's ready.
Stan turned. Max had joined them on the deck. Stan couldn't be sure how long he'd been standing there, or how much he'd heard.
Great, Claire said. Let's eat.
On their way back inside, Max fixed Stan with a long, hard look. Then they all went inside to eat dinner. Claire had prepared an enormous tray of cannelloni, gluten-free for Flo, mac and cheese, because Billy didn't like Napoli sauce, and a mixed bean salad. The dining table was big enough to fit the five of them along with all the food without disrupting the unfinished jigsaw puzzle at the other end. Stan wasn't hungry, but he spooned a helping of everything onto his plate and forced himself to eat.
So, kids, he said, how's school?
Billy's into science, Claire said, answering for them. Last weekend, he made a volcano out of dish soap and white vinegar or something. It was amazing.
And baking soda,
Billy chimed in, sitting back coolly in his chair, moving his mac and cheese around his plate.
It was pretty cool.
Billy's sister Flo was leaning forward, getting stuck into her cannelloni like a prison inmate.
How about you, Flo? Stan asked. Do you like school?
Sometimes,
she said with her mouth full.
But sometimes not. She has a boyfriend,
Billy teased.
Do not,
Flo said.
Oh yeah? Then who's Craig Yang? Craig is a boy and a friend, but he's not my boyfriend,
she said. Max topped up everyone's glasses and said,
So Stan, there's this woman at Claire's work. What's her name, hon?
Susie Vandenberg, Claire said with a soft, sinister smile.
Right, Susie Vandenberg, Max said. She's recently divorced, drop-dead gorgeous, soup kitchen friendly, roll around on the floor funny.
I think he gets the point, Claire said.
Anyway, I was thinking if you were into the idea, maybe Claire could give you her number. What do you say?
I don't know, Stan said. Stan doesn't need to be fixed up, Claire said, and he really doesn't need to be fixed up by us. I'm sure he's been back on the horse a while now. Flo snorted and said,
Ha! Horse!
Well, don't keep us in suspense, Stan, Max said. Is there a lucky lady we don't know about?
No, he said. I don't think I'm quite ready for that.
Ready for what?
Flo asked.
To fall in love, Claire said. How about you, Flo? Are you ready to fall in love with Craig Yang?
Flo thought it over and said,
Maybe, if he made me pancakes.
They all laughed at that. A cheeky grin climbed over Flo's face. She turned to her brother and said,
Did you hear what I said, Billy? I said maybe if Craig made me pancakes, I'd change my mind.
I'm sitting right here, Billy said.
What about that other thing, Stan? Claire asked. That woman you told me about? The psychic?
Wow, you know a sidekick?
Flo said. Psychic, honey. Someone who can talk to ghosts, Claire said.
Oh.
Flo said glumly, and returned to her cannelloni.
She's not a psychic,
Stan corrected for the second time that night. He looked over the table to Max, who had wanted him to keep things light.
Her daughter's been experiencing past life memories.
What's that? Billy asked.
I'll tell you what it's not, Max said, and that's appropriate dinner table discussion. How about you tell us about your science project, Billy?
Claire opened her mouth to protest, but when Max threw her a strained look, she closed it. Billy finished a mouthful of mac and cheese, set his fork down, and dabbed his mouth with his napkin.
It's a demonstration to demonstrate that plants breathe. You put leaves in a bowl of water and come back later and there are bubbles in the water, and that's proof that plants breathe. It works with flowers too, but flowers are for girls. Sounds kind of like farting in the bath, Flo said.
Billy nodded and in a serious voice said,
It's similar, but not the same.
This was a happy home, Stan thought. A happy home and a happy family. Stan had something like this once. Claire's world was a good one. and what Stan had come here to do would shatter it. He was reminded of the lesson he learned the hard way on that clear afternoon in June all those years ago. We don't know we're living in the good old days until the good old days are gone. They went on making appropriate dinner table small talk for a while. Claire talked about her job. Max talked about a secondhand dirt bike he planned on buying if he could just talk the seller down a few dollars. Billy talked about his favorite classes. Flo talked about her least favorite classes. They kept things light. As Stan talked and ate and listened, he thought about the emotional hand grenade he was holding. He could go on holding it for the sake of Claire and the kids, but the thought of Max getting away with it filled him with a red, dark rage. So, as dinner came to a slow, merciful end, and the kids shifted to the other end of the table to finish their puzzle, Stan and Max took the dirty dishes into the kitchen, and Stan decided it was time. "Just put them in the sink," Claire called from the living room. She was on her knees, flicking through a collection of CDs, trying to find the right one. "I'll load them into the dishwasher before I go to bed."
"It's fine," Stan called. "It won't take long."
When Stan and Max were alone, Stan began to stack the dishwasher while Max put what was left on the plates into the garbage disposal.
"Sorry about before," Max said. "I didn't mean to derail you. I just didn't want you talking about that stuff in front of my kids."
"Or your wife," Stan said. Max held Stan's look for a second, then turned back to the garbage disposal.
"I met her," Stan said.
"The little girl with the past life memories." Max paused.
"Come on, man. You don't actually believe that crap, do you?"
"We talked about you."
"Me?"
"About you and Joanne."
"What about us?"
he asked. There was no trace of guilt or remorse on Max's face. Either he was hiding it well or he didn't feel it.
"I know about the two of you. I know you were sleeping together."
"What the hell are you talking about, dude?"
Max said, gasping like a fish on dry land.
"Did the psychic tell you that?"
"She's not a psychic."
"Look, man, we've tried so hard with you. Claire bends over backwards to treat you like a member of this family. So if you're gonna come into my house and accuse me of something as fucked up as what you're accusing me of because of what some fucking psychic told you."
"No,"
Stan said. He reached into his hip pocket and took out a folded sheet of paper. Feeling shaky and unreal, he handed it to Max.
"What's this?"
Max asked.
"I still have access to Joanne's email account. She deleted the emails you sent each other except for one. It was saved to her drafts folder. I guess she forgot to look there. Or maybe she wanted me to find it."
Max unfolded the sheet of paper and read. "To Max Borden, from Joanne Weir. Subject, empty. Date, April 3rd, 2012. Dear Max, scientists say there are other dimensions that exist alongside this one. It has something to do with quantum physics. My point is, in another reality, you and I could have been happy together. You are a good man, Max. You've been there for me. In a lifetime, I believe a person only gets two or three real connections. You were one of mine, and I hope I was one of yours too. After the accident, you were there for me in ways Stan couldn't be. You lifted me up. You held me together. You carried me through. I don't know how I would have survived without you. I'll forever be thankful for what we've shared. There's always a but. We live in this reality, and this can't go on. I love my husband and my sister too much to hurt them like this. It hurts too much to carry this guilt around on top of all the other shit I'm carrying. So, for now, this is goodbye. We'll always be in each other's lives, but from here on out, it'll be as friends and as siblings-in-law. In dreams and in other dimensions, we lie together. Yours always, Joe. X.
Max let his eyes linger on the words for a few beats, then scrunched the paper into a tight ball.
This isn't what it looks like,
Max said, keeping his voice below the music that was now drifting in from the living room. Claire had chosen a Journey CD.
When did it start?
Stan asked, surprising himself with his calm.
When did you start fucking my wife? Jesus, keep your voice down. My kids are in the next room, for Christ's sake. It was 9 years ago, Stan. Can't we just leave it all in the past?
No, Stan said, flat and simple. Max's cheeks turned a rosy pink. He was using a knife to scrape the leftover food into the garbage disposal. He looked down at the knife now. Was he intending to use it on Stan?
Joanne and me, we're the same,
Max whispered. Tears caught in his throat.
We both carried shit around with us. Both made sure everyone else was wearing their oxygen mask before we put our own one on.
Slow tears crept down his face. Journey's Don't Stop Believin' pumped in from the living room.
We didn't mean for it to start, and when it did start, we didn't mean for it to mean anything,
he said.
But we saw something in each other. She cared about me, and I cared about her. Then, after Lucy died, she was hurting bad. She just wanted to feel something, something else. This is your fault, you know. We could have been together. She could have still been alive. But she wouldn't leave you. And you know why?
Stan's hands balled into fists. He said nothing.
She was scared for you. She knew you couldn't survive without her. It's your fault, Stan. It's your fault she's dead.
The words cut through him like an axe through dry wood. He closed his eyes, and in the still darkness behind them, he saw Lucy.
I came here thinking I had it all figured out,
Stan said.
Aaron told me what happened on the bridge that night. But she didn't tell me why. Who's Aaron?
I thought you pushed her because you were scared she'd tell Claire about you.
But you pushed her because you couldn't have her to yourself. What? What are you talking about? I wasn't at the bridge that night. Don't,
Stan said.
You texted her, told her to meet you there, threatened to jump if she didn't come to your rescue.
Max looked at Stan like he was a stranger he was trying to place.
You think I hurt Joanne?
He said. He looked down at the knife in his hand. He was holding the handle so tightly, his knuckles had turned white. He let it drop into the sink and said,
I would never hurt her, Stan. I couldn't. Why should I believe you? Because I was in love with her.
They both heard it at the same time. A tight, muffled, desperate sob, like a dog in pain. They turned. Claire was standing in the kitchen doorway. Her glass of red was in one hand. The other was covering her mouth, holding in a shriek. She might not have heard it all, but she had heard enough. Stan looked back at Max. He was crying harder now. Max and Claire were on opposite ends of the kitchen, but he reached out to her anyway, groping the air like a thespian.
No,
he uttered.
Claire!
She dabbed her eyes with the sleeve of her blouse, set the wine glass down on the counter, and said,
Get out! Wait, Claire!
Max pleaded.
It was a mistake. It was years ago, and
I wasn't talking to you, she said. Then slowly, she turned to Stan and said, Get out.
He was on the bridge that night, Claire,
Stan said.
He couldn't stand the thought of Joanne ending their relationship and Get out!
The scream was so loud and sudden that Stan nearly toppled over backwards. Claire was staring at him, lips slightly parted, eyes narrow. There was raw fury in those eyes. Her children appeared behind her. Flo led the way, while Billy slunk in behind her.
Mom, what's going on?
Flo asked meekly.
Go to your rooms. But
go to your fucking rooms right now!
Claire screamed. The twins shrunk away like scolded pets.
Claire, you don't understand. Max was at the bridge that night.
He's lying,
Max said. Defeated and broken, Claire turned to Stan and said,
Please, just go.
So he did. Stan walked to the bus shelter at the bottom of Pickett Street, feeling lost and bewildered. He waited for the downtown bus alongside a young couple sitting arm in arm on the plastic bench, sharing Chinese takeout. It was a still, warm night. He thought about Joanne. It was bad enough picturing her making that leap herself. Now he saw Max's big hands coming toward her, shoving her hard over the railings. Or had he grabbed her by the ankles, lifted her backwards and over, or had Max been telling the truth? Now that Stan's rage fog had dissipated, the idea that Max might be innocent kept nagging at him. Not innocent of adultery, he confessed to that, but innocent of Joanne's murder. His words echoed in his head. I would never hurt her, Stan. I couldn't, because I was in love with her. But of course Max would deny it. He had denied the affair until Stan had shown him evidence. The bus arrived, and Stan got on ahead of the Chinese takeout couple. He found a seat in the back and leaned his head against the window. For the first time in a long time, he couldn't wait to get home. He arrived back at his house at 11:15. Halfway to the front door, he froze. There was a small figure standing just outside the range of the porch light. It was too dark to make out any details, but Stan got the strong impression he was being stared at. He thought of the eyes appearing out of the mist in Aaron's hypnotic regression.
Hello? Stan asked.
Hi, Stan.
The voice was low and cold, but familiar.
Claire?
Can I come in? She asked. We have a lot to talk about. Stan showed Claire into the house. He offered her a scotch, but she declined. Stan poured himself one, a big one, then returned to the living room where Claire was waiting for him. They sat across from one another, neither of them wanting to speak first. Stan gulped down a mouthful, then blurted,
I won't let this go, Claire. Max was there that night on the bridge. He killed her. My wife. Your sister.
For a second, Claire just looked at him. Did that little girl really tell you about Max and Joanne?
Yes. There was evidence in Joanne's emails, but I would never have known to look if not for Aaron. She's telling the truth, Claire.
He hesitated, then added,
I could arrange for you two to meet. I didn't believe her in the beginning, but she changed my mind. She's special.
So you believe her? Claire asked. You think Joanne is somehow inside her? There was no sense of mocking or disbelief in her tone. She was asking a genuine question.
She's been right about everything, Stan said.
Not everything. My husband was nowhere near the bridge that night.
I'm sure you want to believe that, he said. Max texted Joanne the night she died, asking her to meet him out at Prospect. I'm sure he's covered his tracks, but the police could access his phone records. I found that email. I can find more evidence. I'll prove it, Claire, to you and to the police. Aaron can help us.
I texted her that night, Claire said. There was a strange warmth to her statement, as if she were delivering safe, normal news. I used Max's phone, so she thought the texts were coming from him.
If you're trying to cover for him?
I'm not, she said. I knew about the affair, Stan. Max is good at a lot of things, but he's not good at lying. I saw the way he was around Joanne. That night we came to your house, the night she died, I saw the way he looked at her. So I checked his phone. It was all there, in black and white.
Why didn't you tell anyone?
Don't get me wrong, I wanted to. I wanted to kick Max out on his ass and cut my sister loose, but they only would have ended up together in exile. So, I didn't tell anyone, not even Max. I would have carried their secret around forever, and they could have had their fun.
Why didn't you?
Because it was more than just fun for them. Max wanted to leave me for her. He said so in his texts. Joanne resisted. Despite all this, despite Lucy, she loved you. Stan, I love you, Aaron had said during her hypnotic regression. But I hate you too. Joanne was always the better sister, she said. Smarter, prettier, funnier, younger. Hell, she was even taller. Compared to me, she was an upgrade. I couldn't blame him for wanting to be with her. I wasn't mad. Not really. Not at Max and not at her, but I didn't want to lose him, Stan. I couldn't lose him.
So you pushed her.
Claire's eyes were red and raw, but she wasn't crying anymore. She nodded once. Give me 24 hours to get my things in order, she said. I won't run. I just want to get my things in order. Then I'll go to the police myself. It's time I faced up to my sins. Stan thought about Joanne's final moments again. It wasn't Max that pushed her. It was her sister. Had Claire explained her reasoning before she did it? Or had she simply shoved her off the bridge without a word? Was Joanne's final thought, why? Stan wasn't sure he could stand to know the answer, so he didn't ask.
Why would I give you that?
Stan asked. Because all I want is one more day with Max and the kids, she said. And because we're still family.
24 hours,
he said. Thank you, Stan.
Does Max know?
He asked. No. I'm going home to tell him now, she said. I don't expect he'll ever forgive me, but I'll make him see it wasn't about revenge. I didn't do anything out of anger or hate.
If it wasn't about revenge, what was it about?
Love, she said. A sob escaped her. As soon as she got started, the tears kept flowing. She leaned forward with her face in her hands and went on weeping like that, well into the night. For a long time after she left, Stan wept too. Later, after Claire was gone and Stan had gone to bed, he lay awake and looked deep into the black void in the ceiling. He was confident he knew the truth now, but something still bothered him. Come to think of it, a lot of things bothered him. But one nagging thought stood out above the rest. Aaron told him Max lured Joanne to Prospect Bridge with the text message. That part was true, but she hadn't known he wasn't there to meet her. How could she have got everything else so right, but that one part so wrong? Chapter 8. Marcy. A long time ago, Marcy read something about mothers who could sense when their children were in trouble. There was an article in a magazine called Paranormal Monthly that, for reasons unknown, had been in her dentist's waiting room. There was an account of a young man who was shot and killed in the Vietnam War. At the exact moment of his death, on the other side of the world, his mother reportedly sat up in bed and told her husband that their son was dead. There was another story of a young mother who, against all logic, knew that her 4-year-old daughter had a brain tumor, long before any of the symptoms started to show. People thought she was crazy, but thanks to her mysterious forewarning, they were able to operate early, and the girl made a full recovery. When asked to explain what had happened, the woman was quoted as saying, "Sometimes a mother just knows." Marcy had been called into the dentist's office and had forgotten all about the article until now. It came back to her when she found Aaron in the Happy Home parking lot, leaning against the Toyota, hugging her backpack and staring at her feet. It came back to her because suddenly, Marcy knew. "You didn't recognize Mrs. Brevig because you don't remember her," she said. "You don't remember any of it, do you?" "I want to go home," Aaron said, squeezing her backpack tighter. Marcy knelt to meet her daughter's eyes. There were tears in them. "Aaron, I'm not mad, I just need you to be honest with me, Marcy said. Did you make all those things up?
Slowly, Aaron whispered.
It was supposed to be a game.
The sun was beating down on the shadeless parking lot, but Marcy felt suddenly cold.
How? She asked. How did you know all those things?
Aaron looked up. Tears were streaming freely down her face now. She set her backpack down on the blacktop and unzipped it. She reached in and came up with a small object wrapped in a dish rag she must have found at home. She handed the object to Marcy.
What's this? Marcy asked.
Aaron said nothing as Marcy unwrapped it.
Parceled up in the dish rag was a cell phone, switched off.
Where did you get this? She asked. Aaron slumped against the car, looked at her feet, and shrugged.
Marcy turned on the phone. A little white symbol glowed as it booted up. After what felt like an age, it came to life with a cheery electronic chirp. On the screen was a skinny young girl, smiling for the camera, standing knee-deep in what looked like Lake Chancey. She was wearing a mariner's cap.
Whose phone is this? Marcy asked, but she was pretty sure she already knew.
Aaron tugged at a loose thread on her t-shirt and said,
JoJo's.
She couldn't speak on the drive home. She couldn't look at Aaron, who was still and silent on the passenger side. As they approached their tall brick apartment building, she heard heavy metal music drifting down from an open window and caught the smell of weed on the air. The front gate was propped open with a cinder block and a sign on the door read, Buzzers are broke. Someone had drawn a smiley face beside it. Someone else had crossed out the smiley face and written, Fuck you.
Marcy and Aaron slipped past the gate as they'd done countless times, through the front door and into an elevator, which dragged them up to the fifth floor. As they walked down the short hallway to their apartment, Marcy heard a crying baby, the shouts of an angry tenant on the phone to the telephone company, and someone watching an action movie at full volume. A shameful thought came to her.
This is no place for a kid. I'm a terrible mother, she thought.
Once inside the apartment, Marcy locked herself inside the bathroom with Joanne Weir's phone and dove into it. A fluorescent tube buzzed overhead. The bathroom curtain drifted in a cool evening breeze. Somewhere out in the apartment, Aaron was brooding. In the bathroom, Marcy was scared. No, she'd been scared when she thought her daughter was having genuine past life regressions. Now that she knew she'd made the whole thing up, she was terrified. And she had made it all up. Everything she needed to sell the lie was right there in the palm of her hand. Joanne's phone contained text messages, emails, photos, and videos. If there was one thing that knew you better than anyone else, maybe even better than you knew yourself, it was your damn phone. On her hypnotic regression tape, Aaron had said, I'm in a big building in the city. I'm on a high-up floor, not all the way at the top, but close. The walls are the kind made of glass, so you can see all the way to the overpass.
Here was a photo taken by Joanne from her desk, a view of the overpass on a clear day. Aaron had said her name was JoJo, and here was an email from Norma Brevig, who now lived in Happy Home surrounded by cat paintings. The email was discussing a trip to Henderson they had planned. Norma wanted to know what flavor ice cream Lucy preferred, and whether or not pork chops complied with Stan's ketogenic diet. She had started the email, Dear JoJo. Aaron had told Marcy and Matsui that her husband wanted to know if she'd be home for dinner, and here was a text from Stan asking just that. During her regression, Aaron had recited Joanne's reply word for word. I'll just grab something from the vending machine or have an intern run out and get me something. Details about the way Stan and Joanne met were described in emails. The song Aaron sang featured in a video Joanne had shot with the phone that showed a much younger Lucy. Dancing along, wiggling around when the caterpillar was mentioned, then stretching her arms out to become a butterfly in time with the lyrics. The rest Aaron must have found out online, using Joanne's name, personal details, and a lot of youthful tech know-how. She probably found the same article Marcy had read. She was smart for her age, Marcy thought. Or maybe she was a natural-born liar. The final series of texts painted a grim picture of Joanne Weir's final moments. Max, I miss you, X. Joanne, please don't. Max, I can't help it. I can't sleep. I keep thinking about you. I'm not sure I can do this. I know I said I was fine, but I'm not fine. Joanne, we can't be together. Max, why? Joanne, you know why. Because I love Stan and we both love my sister. Max, you don't love Stan. Joanne, part of me does. A big part. Max, and the other part? There were no more messages for a week. Then on April 4th, 2012, the night of Joanne's death and Aaron's birth. Max, meet me. Joanne, now? It's the middle of the night. Joanne, Max, we've talked about this. Max, I don't care. If you don't meet me, I don't know what I'll do. The next text came several minutes later. Joanne, what does that mean? Max, I'm driving out to the bridge. Joanne, what? Max, Prospect Bridge, 1 hour. If you're not there, I jump. Joanne, for fuck's sake, Max, this is crazy. Joanne, question mark, question mark, question mark. Joanne, I'm on my way. It didn't take an investigative genius to figure out what happened next. All it took was one bright, slightly maniacal 9-year-old. Marcy had been outsmarted by that 9-year-old and felt desperately foolish for it. She picked herself up off the floor, pocketed Joanne's phone, and walked out into the hallway. Aaron's bedroom door was slightly ajar. A Harry Potter nightlight cast the room beyond in blue. It was a mess. There were nests of dirty clothing on the floor and Legos spread across the carpet. Aaron's closet was wide open. Inside was a graveyard of old stuffed toys. Since all this business with the memories and the nightmares, Joanne had let her daughter off the hook for her chores. Aaron was tangled in the covers. She'd sleep soundly all night, Marcy thought, now that she wouldn't be up having fake nightmares. Aaron, Marcy said, are you awake? Aaron was either asleep or pretending to be. Marcy briefly considered walking on down the hall and going to bed. That's how she used to deal with problems when she was a teenager. She felt desperate and alone. She decided this was the hardest night to be a single parent. Then she pushed open Aaron's door and flicked on the light. Aaron rolled over to face her mother. She hadn't been sleeping after all.
Hey, she said in a small voice. I don't want to talk about JoJo.
Marcy sat down on the bed and said, Well, to be honest with you, neither do I, but you know what Grandfather used to say? Truth is like a big old poop. Always better out than in. Aaron didn't smile. She sat up in bed, tucked her hair behind her ears, and sighed.
Grandpa said that?
Almost every day, Marcy said. I'm not angry at you, honey. I'm not going to punish you, but I need you to help me understand. Get that truth poop out, and I think we'll both feel better.
It was just a game, Aaron said. I get bored. And when I drew that picture and everyone freaked out, I wasn't so bored anymore. People noticed me.
So the nightmares, they weren't real? Aaron shook her head. The hypnotic regression with Mr. Matsui.
I was playing pretend, she said. I wanted to tell you, but...
But what?
It was fun.
Fun? Aaron looked up at her. Her face tightened.
Yeah, fun. It was fun for you too, wasn't it?
No, honey, it wasn't fun, Marcy said. Not for me and not for Mr. Weir. It was scary. I was worried about you. But as she said the words, something stirred deep inside Marcy. The reason she had believed so willingly, something that she'd not been ready to admit to herself until that moment, burst into the front of her mind so quickly and so wholly that she nearly lost her balance. It had been fun. It had been an escape. Marcy hadn't planned on being a single mother, living in a budget-deprived apartment complex in Milden, spending her 9-to-5s in the musty halls of Happy Home. She was bored, and all this business with Aaron was an escape from that boredom. Aaron wasn't the one looking for attention. Marcy was. The revelation rocked her. She hadn't just encouraged Aaron's behavior. She'd rewarded and fostered it. Perhaps reading the grave expression on Marcy's face, Aaron said,
"Do you still think I'm special?"
Aaron asked. Marcy's heart broke. "Yes, honey," she said. "You were special before all this, and you're special now."
"I'm sorry, Mom."
"Me too," Marcy told her. "All right. One more question, and I'll let you get to sleep. Where did you get JoJo's phone?"
"You know I hate to say I told you so," Barb said. "But I did tell you so, several times, come to think of it."
It was nearing midnight, but Barb had sensed the strange urgency in her daughter's voice when she called and had driven over the second she got off the phone, just as Marcy knew she would. She had arrived in her nightclothes, gray sweatpants, and a huge billowing t-shirt with a picture of Garfield on the front and the words, "I hate Mondays." They sat at the table drinking coffee, talking in hushed tones because Aaron was asleep. "Please spare me the lecture, Mom," Marcy said.
"Why would I do that?" Barb said. But she must have seen the grief in Marcy's face, because she did spare her the lecture. Instead, she said, "You're not a bad mother, kid."
"Do you really mean that?"
"I do. Motherhood is about giving life, but that's only part of it."
Barb smiled, then reached out to take Marcy's hand. Barb had never been the most demonstrative person, so the gesture felt significant to Marcy. More than that, it felt good.
"Good motherhood is about giving life every day. You give Aaron life. You work for her. You love for her. And you hurt for her. I'm proud of you, Marcy. I guess I don't tell you that enough."
"It's good to hear now," Marcy said. They sipped their coffee and listened to the nighttime sounds of the neighborhood. Insects chirping, wind blowing gently against the screen windows, a late-night talk show playing at high volume in the next apartment. It wasn't peace, but it was something close.
"So tell me," Barb said. "Did you get me out of bed in the middle of the night for a pep talk? Because I could have given you that over the phone and saved the mileage."
"Actually, no," Marcy said. "When I asked Aaron where she got Joanne Weir's phone, she told me something weird. She said she found it at your place."
Barb chortled. "She lies about there being the spirit of a dead woman living inside her, so I suppose it's no surprise she'd lie about where she got the—"
Barb froze. Marcy had just taken Joanne's phone from her pocket and set it down on the table between them. Slowly, Barb put down her coffee and picked up the phone. She stared at it, turned it over twice in her hands, as if it were something she'd lost.
"What is it?" Marcy asked. "I'd forgotten all about this thing," she said. "Aaron must have dug it out of my storage closet."
"So she did get it at your house?" Barb nodded once and looked at the phone in stunned silence. "Mom, why do you have Joanne Weir's phone?"
"You probably won't remember this," Barb started. "But on the night Aaron was born, some paramedics left a dead body outside your room."
"What?" Marcy said. "That didn't happen. You must be—" But just then, a memory jumped to the front of her mind. She remembered the steel gurney with the squeaky wheel, a small body covered with a plastic sheet, two small feet poking out the bottom, with one shoe missing.
"God, you're right," she said.
I went out into the hall to ask them to move it, Barb said. I didn't want Aaron coming into this world with a corpse parked right outside. They wheeled that poor soul on its way, but she held up the phone. This fell out.
I picked it up, and I was about to call out when...
When I called your name, Marcy finished. She'd been scared her mother would miss the birth. I guess I put it in my pocket and didn't think about it until I got home the next day, Barb said.
I know I should have given it back.
Why didn't you? Marcy asked. If you were scared of getting into trouble, I'm sure they wouldn't have...
It wasn't that, Barb said sadly. I just didn't want to think about it.
Think about what?
About that poor woman, Barb said. I've never been great around death. So I shut that thing away and forgot about it.
Just as she'd shut away her grief when her husband died, Marcy thought. You know, Marcy said, Joanne Weir's body being there when Aaron was born is strangely comforting if you think about it.
How's that?
Aaron might not be the reincarnated spirit of anyone, but one soul left this world as another came into it.
Comforting is one word for it, Barb said with a laugh.
Marcy wondered if Stan would find it comforting too, and knew that it was time to tell him the truth.
Chapter 9. Stan.
Hello, my name is Stan Weir, and I'm a grief survivor.
Hi, Stan, the group said in unison. He was back at the Milden Community Center for Life After Death. It was another warm night and another good turnout, with the same lukewarm instant coffee and the same stale pastries. The prehistoric air conditioning unit was making a lot of noise, but doing little to cool the air, so as usual, the back doors had been propped open to let the breeze in. Harold Dahlgren, the group facilitator, was in the same seat he always took, wearing the same blue shirt tucked into the same cargo shorts. Everything was the same, except for Stan. Something fundamental had changed inside him. He wasn't sure what that was exactly, but he'd come to trust his deep truth well to gurgle up the answer. So he shared.
My wife had this joke, he started. She said, I know the real you, and somehow against all the odds, I love you anyway.
A murmur of laughter moved through the group.
I'd never really thought about what that meant until this week. See, my wife's been dead for 9 years, and I'm still learning new things about her. Life is weird like that. So is death, come to think of it. You think you know everything there is to know about a person, but that's rarely how it works.
Margaret Bethune dabbed at her eyes with a Kleenex. Margaret Bethune was always crying. Jim Adkins nodded along to Stan's words. Dahlgren leaned forward, head tilted at a sympathetic angle.
Sometimes you learn nice things about a person after they're gone, Stan said. Like, a week after Joanne died, a parcel arrived for her in the mail. It was a copy of The Dark Tower, The Wind Through the Keyhole by Stephen King. It was a birthday gift for me. But sometimes what you find out isn't so nice.
He paused, listening to his truth well gurgle, and said,
It's hard to get mad at someone when they're dead, isn't it? You can't have it out with them, and they certainly can't defend themselves, but I think it's important to know the bad stuff, too. You don't know a person until you get the whole picture, the good and the bad. And I think that's what Joanne's joke was all about.
He surprised himself by smiling.
I know exactly who Joanne was before she died, he said. And somehow, against all the odds, I love her anyway.
He looked to the back of the room just as two familiar faces stepped into the community center. Marcy was wearing the same denim cutoffs she'd worn when they met. She was holding Aaron's hand. Marcy gave him a strange little smile. Before Stan had the chance to return it, the smile faded.
So, none of it was real?
Stan asked glumly. The three of them had gone across the street to the same all-night diner. They ordered coffee and a caramel malt for Aaron. The waitress with the corn-colored hair was working again. She was flirting with the kitchen staff via the serving hatch.
I'm so sorry, Stan, Marcy said. And Aaron's sorry, too.
Aaron shifted in her seat and looked down at her malt sadly. Marcy had put Joanne's phone on the table between them, and now Stan picked it up.
Didn't you ever wonder what happened to it?
Marcy asked.
No,
Stan said, feeling foolish.
I guess I assumed it was kept as evidence or something. God, I've spent too long on autopilot.
He switched on the phone. Lucy's face appeared on the screen. It brought a warm, genuine smile to his face.
I remember when this was taken, he said. We got Lucy a tent for her 10th birthday, and she insisted on setting it up in the backyard. She asked if she could sleep in it overnight. Joanne and I told her she could because we both assumed she'd be back in the house before 10, but she lasted the night out and even looked rested the next morning.
He held the phone tightly. There's some stuff on there that might be hard to see, Marcy said. I read some of the messages. I'm sorry. I had to know. Stan had expected as much, but there was no hurry to read them. Maybe he never would.
Are we still friends?
Aaron asked.
I'll think about it, he said, then smiled. Of course we're still friends. You know why?
Why?
Because even though Joanne wasn't inside you, I think she might have had a hand in all this from wherever she is now. She might have wanted me to learn the truth so I could move on.
Marcy tilted her head and smiled. In the yellow light of the diner, she looked sun-kissed and beautiful.
Do you really believe that?
She asked.
I don't know,
he said.
What are you going to do now?
I think I'm going to sell the house, move someplace smaller, maybe in Henderson, on the lake. That's where Joanne and I got engaged. Then, I don't know. I guess I should probably start thinking about the future.
Remembering the tape of Aaron's regression, he pictured Takashi Matsui's coastline, unexplored and unwritten. It didn't seem so scary anymore.
That sounds great, Marcy said.
But I meant, what are you going to do now? We haven't eaten. I was thinking about ordering some food.
He looked at them and smiled.
Sure, he said. I could eat.
This has been an Audible Original, produced by Audible Originals, written by Kristen White, performed by Ellen Archer. Executive producers, Stacey Creamer and Ben Napperstek. Producer, Kat Lambrix. Vice President of Audible Studios, Mike Charzik. Editor-in-Chief, Audible Original Publishing, David Blum. Copyright 2020 by Kristen White. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.